Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Nachum Segal Network. Hope everyone had a wonderful Pesach and a fantastic holiday season, as we would say. Welcome to a new edition of By the Book, our friends at Koren Publications. And in this case, Toby Press, which is an imprint of Koren, bring you an incredible hour each and every week in its original form, Tuesday at 10 a.m. with some of the most amazing authors, editors, illustrators. It could be anybody in the world of books who's made an impact, especially with recent works. And it's always a pleasure to bring this segment to you. Today we get to speak about one of the greats in the world of literature, somebody who, to the average Jewish student, especially those who attended Jewish institutions, most likely have heard of. And I refer, of course, to Shai Agnon. And with us via telephone is the editor of the brand new S.Y. Shai Agnon series from Toby Press, and that is Rabbi Jeffrey Sachs. Rabbi Sachs was the series editor of the Toby Press Agnon series, and he is the founding director of ATID, the Academy for Torah Initiatives and Directions in Jewish Education in the city of Jerusalem. He's a scholar in Agnon and directs the Agnon House in Yerushalayim. Prior to his aliyah in the mid-90s, he served on the faculty of Yeshiva University High School for Girls, and upon arriving in Israel, was the director of Yeshivat HaMiftar in Efrat, and subsequently of Yeshivat Or Yerushalayim in Beit Meir. Rabbi Jeffrey Sachs, welcome to the Nachum Segal Network.
Hello, Nachum Segal. Just a quick correction. I'm not the director of the Agnon House in Jerusalem, but I do lecture there regularly.
Okay. I apologize for that. Didn't mean to promote you without your knowledge.
That's all right.
How did your before we talk about Agnon and explain to our audience who he was and why he's so significant, and we'll talk about at least one of his works, how did your fascination with him begin?
So that's an interesting question and a long story, which I'll try to cut short. I grew up in suburban New Jersey. I was a public school kid growing up and becoming interested in Jewish things largely through NCSY, where I would listen to the old Nachum Segal show. When I was in high school, I had a grandmother. All of my grandparents, interestingly, were born in America, and none of them were observant. None of them spoke Yiddish. There was no old world in any kind of direct connection to me. But I had one grandmother who was very, let's say, culturally engaged with Judaism. And had there been a Hebrew author sitting in Jerusalem who was awarded the Nobel Prize, as there was, it would not have been lost on her. So when I was becoming interested in things Jewish, she bought me a copy of what was then called 21 Stories. It was a collection of short stories by Agnon in translation to English. And I had never heard of him, and I certainly at that point would not have been able to read Agnon in Hebrew. And much of the richness of what he's doing in his writing is the weaving together of what we know as the world of the Beit Midrash, the world of Gemara and Midrash and rabbinic writing and Tanakh and the entirety of the Jewish bookshelf kind of distilled down into modern literature. All of those references would have gone completely over my head, did go completely over my head, even if I were to have been able to read in the original Hebrew. But yet still, I was very fascinated by what I read there. And I became interested. When I came in Aliyah 20 years ago, I made an attempt to try to read Agnon in Hebrew. And it was very rough going at first, and it took a while until my Hebrew was up to speed to read him in the original. And a number of years ago, I did a kind of, almost on a whim, I did an experiment where I decided I could read all of Agnon cover to cover. In the collected writings, there are 24 fat volumes. And I decided I could read all of, well, not exactly like Daf Yomi, if you'll pardon the comparison, but that I could read all of the writings of Agnon cover to cover. And my wife compared it to, remember that film a few years ago about the woman who decides she's going to cook every recipe in
right.
the
Julia Child.
Julia Child's cookbook?
Right.
that the whole thing becomes a metaphor for itself.
Right.
You learn a lot about the thing you've immersed yourself in, but of course it becomes a process of self-discovery, and you end up learning a lot about yourself. And anyway, I became something of an expert, and I began lecturing at the Agnon House, which was the home that he lived in through much of his life in the Talpiot section of Jerusalem, which is today a museum and a study center. And we have a group of people, and those lectures are also broadcast through our Web Yeshiva program. My day job, as you mentioned, is running running Atid,
right.
This organization that deals with things together with Rabbi Chaim Bravender, things in the larger world of Jewish education. And our flagship program is webyeshiva.org, which is a fully interactive online Jewish learning platform. And we broadcast in an interactive way, although you can also get the archives, those lectures from the Agnon House on Web Yeshiva. If you go to www.webyeshiva.org/Agnon, A-G-N-O-N, you can find the archives or information about upcoming lectures and programs. So it's become something very interesting. There aren't too many people who are particularly Americans and English speakers who are experts in Agnon, so it's created a little niche where I've been able to read and write and publish, and now I'm involved with this project at Toby.
Right. All right, you've given us You've given us a lot here. There's a lot to ask about and certainly a lot to talk about regarding both Agnon and your work with Toby Press. Rabbi Jeffrey Sachs is with us. What was it about Agnon that made him one of the only names that someone like myself growing up, you mentioned your experience in terms of discovering him. In my case as well, he's one of the very few that had anything to do with Hebrew literature or literature that concentrated on what we would call, you know, living in the state of Israel or bringing today's times, you know, into focus based on, you know, the times of yesteryear. One of the only people. Why is he the Babe Ruth, so to speak, of that era, of that area?
Well, I think, you know, just like Babe Ruth, you know, broke the records, Shai Agnon is the only Hebrew author ever awarded the Nobel Prize. When he was awarded the prize for literature, in 1966, he was the first Israeli to win the prize. We've gone on, of course, to win many other prizes, but not in Hebrew literature. We've won for peace, and we've won for science, and for other things, but he's the only Hebrew author, and of course, there are many Jewish writers, American Jewish writers as well, who have won the Nobel for literature. But he's the only one to win for writing in Hebrew. And insofar as he was the first Israeli to win, so that certainly set him on a pedestal. But even before he won the prize, and he was towards the end of his life, he won the prize in 1966. He was almost 80 years old. He was in his late 70s, and he died in 1970. When he won the prize in 66, he was already long established as the grand old man of Hebrew literature. And certainly after he won the prize, but even beforehand, he was people that read any Hebrew literature,
right.
Particularly those that were educated in American day schools where there was a Hebrew literature emphasis in the curriculum, although one suspects it's been whittled away over the years,
right.
As the state of Hebrew in America. So he would have been on it. Many of his stories, and he wrote in a very wide variety of genres, and from the very, very short story, things that could be read as children's literature, although they're really not, to long, multi-hundred-page, modern-style novels, what was at the time contemporary modern-style novels written in the 30s and 40s, which would not have been so accessible to a younger reader,
right.
Necessarily. But there's plenty of material that can be excerpted or pointed to, which would be very appropriate to use in Jewish education.
Yeah, I can.
And those are probably the stories that are well known to those who still know Agnon's writing.
Yeah, I can attest based on my own youth experience that the Nobel Prize was a big deal, you know, just like we used the Babe Ruth comparison, and he's the automatic answer to the all-time home run king, at least for a while. So too, when you were looking, you know, in the world of Jewish Connection, remember that book, Jewish Connection, where anything and everything that was great about this world, you somehow tried to connect to somebody who was Jewish.
The ultimate Jewish geography.
Exactly. So you went ahead and took great pride in the fact that there actually was a Nobel laureate that was based in Hebrew and in Israel. Excuse me for spending a little bit of time on the minutia. I tend to do that, but when one enters the qualifications or gets into the arena of being a Nobel laureate, does their work have to be understood by everybody? Is there a committee who specifically...
Well, there's a committee of judges that sit in Stockholm. You're not awarded the prize for a book. You're awarded it for a body of work.
Right.
His work was already... Part of the interesting thing in his biography is... let me just sketch his biography very, very briefly so that you can understand the background. Agnon was born in a little town called Buchach, which was in Galicia, in Austro-Hungarian Galicia, which today is in the western part of Ukraine. And he was born into a completely traditional family. His father was a Rav and a Talmud Chacham, although he worked for a living in the fur trade. Agnon went off to Cheder as a little boy, but after a couple of years, the Cheder Rebbe tells his father, he's an Ilui, he's a genius, you should learn with him at home, you know, which was something that was done. Rabbi Soloveitchik had a similar experience in his own upbringing. And he learned with his father, but since his father at work, he would go off to the... There was a kind of Beit Midrash / library in the town, and in the mornings he would sit and he would read, and he had one of those kinds of photographic memories. He would read and learn, and then in the afternoons and evenings he would study with his father, principally Gemara and traditional curriculum, but it was a somewhat open household. He was born in either 1888 or, in fact, he was born in 1887. He kind of always fabricated details about his biography. But at that point, it was already something of an open home, and he was also exposed to Hebrew, not merely only to Yiddish, but modern Hebrew of the day, literature, poetry, some general literature. The only languages he could really read, of course, were Hebrew and Yiddish and German as well. And his mother also exposed him to some of those things. So he had this kind of poetic and literary bent already as a child. And then he came on Aliyah before the time he was 20. He comes to Yafo, where he abandoned traditional observance for a period of time, which was something of the fashion of people that came on Aliyah in those decades. But at the same time, he comes under the influence of the great Rav Kook, who goes on to become the first chief rabbi of the land of Israel, but at that time was the chief rabbi of Yafo, and he had a lifelong affection and connection to Rav Kook. And in 1912, after he's already established himself as a kind of young up-and-coming author, he's adopted the pen name Agnon. His birth name was Chachkiz. He adopts the pen name Agnon, which he adopts. His first published story in Hebrew when he arrives in Yafo is a story called Agunot, and he takes the name Agnon from that same root. If we have more time later, we can discuss that. And in 1912, he goes off to Germany, and he spends a number of years in Germany where he gets married, he has children. But during that period, and here's the short answer to your question, he comes under the patronage of Shlomo Zalman Shokin. Listeners may know the Shokin Publishing House, which in America is today owned by Random House, really part of Random House. And Shokin became his patron, and he had a lifelong stipend from Shokin, who was a self-made millionaire. He was a department store magnate in Germany. He liquidated his assets in Germany before it was too late and got his fortune out of Germany. And Agnon when he comes to Israel, he buys the Haaretz newspaper, and Agnon becomes the kind of in-house author. He would write stories. Many of the stories that are in the books were first published in the newspaper. Novels would be serialized in the newspaper and then later published in book form. And Shokin understood early on that if you want to have a world-class author, an author who committees in Stockholm take note of, he can't only be writing in Hebrew. So already in the 30s, Shokin was paying to have Agnon's work translated into European languages, into English, even into Swedish, so that people would take note of him. And, you know, there are campaigns to push people forward for this prize or that prize, and that certainly was going on with Agnon, but it took a long time. When he wins the prize in 1966, today, of course, you know, is Yom HaShoah.
Right.
Holocaust Remembrance Day, the committee in their judgment in the declaration is very cognizant of the fact that he is a Hebrew author sitting in Jerusalem. It's 1966. It's you know, 20 years after the Holocaust. The idea that the Jewish people has reconstituted itself, has rebuilt itself, has made a state, has struggled and survived, and not just reconstituted itself physically, but culturally as well, that you have people writing world-class literature sitting in Jerusalem, that was noteworthy. Of course, the fact that 1966 was a year before 1967 and the Six-Day War, when, you know, some of world opinion began to change, is also significant.
And that's not uncommon, by the way. It's not uncommon that that we see Nobel winners, especially in the area of literature, who are not just feted for their incredible careers, but often are symbols of a movement or symbols
of an era.
Right? They represent something a lot more than just that. Rabbi Jeffrey Sachs.
We like to think these prizes are given out just for the merit,
right,
but they're usually larger considerations at work.
Right. Rabbi Jeffrey Sachs is series editor of the Toby Press S.Y. Agnon, Shai Agnon Library. I'll talk more about the library in a moment. Are the translations, now that you in fact are someone who can, you know, read the Hebrew and certainly can appreciate the way it's translated into other languages, would someone like Agnon, or was someone like Agnon, happy and satisfied with the translations? Is there a way to evaluate just how good they are?
So the translations, interestingly, you know, again, the translations began to be undertaken already in the 1930s. Although interestingly, we're far from having a complete translation of the collected writings, and there's still some very important works that have not yet been translated, and it's sometimes surprising why this work was translated and that one hasn't been. But he didn't, you know, sit and evaluate. I don't have any evidence that he sat and evaluated, and certainly, you know, his works were translated into all types of languages that he himself could not read.
Right.
One thinks he didn't pay too much attention to it. He wasn't involved in the work, in the translations that were done in his lifetime. He wasn't working with the translators. I tried to find evidence of that, of translators. There were two or three principal translators that did the bulk of the work, you know, in the 30s, 40s, and 50s and 60s when he was still alive. But there's no evidence that he worked with them or that he collaborated with them. They did their work. The publishers, you know, supervised the work. And you know, they vary greatly. This is true for all translation, but it's particularly true because of the trickiness of the language, of the Agnonian language. Many contemporary modern Hebrew speakers find Agnon's Hebrew, shall I say, off-putting.
Because
he's writing in what Israelis call Agnonic.
Right.
It's a distillation of Chazal. It's a distillation of rabbinic Hebrew. It's not completely the Hebrew you're going to hear on the streets of Jerusalem or Tel Aviv. It has so many echoes and references and things woven between the lines, hearkening back to rabbinic literature, principally to the Mishnah, to you know, the Agadah, to Midrash in particular, that it's a kind of this intertextual, almost like a game, where you're reading something and it points in so many different directions. There's the level of the, as we say, the level of the pshat, and certainly someone can read it without getting any of those references. And presumably those judges in Stockholm were not holding in Gemara and Midrash and Chazal or Hasidic tales or things like that. And you can still read it for plot and character, and but there's so much below the surface that you're missing out on. And a lot of that, of course, is sacrificed in translation by definition. There's a lot of wordplay. Agnon rarely would formulate something in a way which was one-dimensional, which was clear. If he could write something in a way that would point in two directions, that would carry two meanings, he would always do so. I was just reading something earlier today where he talks about Avinu, our father. And it's a story that can be read on the level of pshat, about a child talking about his father. But when we, in Hebrew, hear the word Avinu, we also hear echoes of Avinu Sheba Shemayim, our Father who is in heaven.
Right.
And anybody that knows enough about reading midrashically knows that you can have a story where the pshat is about a little boy and his father, but of course the whole thing is a kind of allegory for the Jewish people and their father in heaven.
Right.
And those are things that get sacrificed sometimes in translation, and the translator is always going to walk this tension between translating more literally and translating more lyrically.
Right.
And the translations were done, one of the translations that we're putting out in the Toby Press series is a story, a very well-known and beloved story, at least still here in Israel, called Tehillah. It's one of the stories that's still a linchpin in the curriculum in schools. And it was translated twice within a couple of years of each other, both in the 50s, right after the story was published in Hebrew. One is a quite literal translation, and one is a quite lyrical translation, a poetic translation, which captures something about the feel and the rhythm of the language, but of course it has to take liberties with the literalism, with translating word for word. So people who can't, when I've taught the story to people who can't read the Hebrew text, can't grapple with the original, I often give them both translations and say, read them both, and you'll find the truth lies somewhere in the middle.
Is there anybody today that comes close to what he did in terms of the play on words?
So that's interesting. There's a contemporary Hebrew author and Rosh Yeshiva by the name of Chaim Sabato, who's a Rosh Yeshiva at the Yeshiva Hesder in Male Adumim, right outside of Jerusalem. And he's also a novelist. He's a very fascinating figure. He's a conventional teacher of Torah, but he's also a novelist. He's written a number of novels, and people often compare him to Agnon, which is something that he does not fully, he accepts it as the compliment that it's meant as.
Right.
What they mean is that he also does this kind of weaving together of, you know, his day job as a teacher of Gemara and Torah with his artistic output as a novelist, as a writer. And it comes through in the way he writes. Although what he's writing about and his agenda as a writer and his attitudes towards the things he's writing about are very different than Agnon. He actually once gave a very lovely talk on this subject at the Agnon House about the influences of Agnon on his writing, but that kind of intertextual weaving together, I think, is the point of comparison between the two of them. But generally speaking, like the big brand name contemporary Israeli writers, people like Amos Oz and Aleph Bet Yehoshua and others, they all point to the influence of Agnon. Mm. Agnon was this, cast a giant shadow over all of, you know, Hebrew literature. And they all write about, you know, that influence and trying to break free of it, because Hebrew literature had to move on. Agnon was very much writing about the old world, both the world in Europe, not just before World War II, but really even before World War I. Most of his stories are set in the from the mid-19th to the early 20th century in Europe, or stories of the Second Aliyah, the wave of Jewish immigration to the land of Israel up to World War I. There are some exceptions to this. It's a big canon of work, but those are the two areas of focus in his writing. In the 60s, in the 70s, in the 80s, Hebrew literature wanted to go in a different direction. They didn't want to write stories about the old world. They wanted to document the Sabra experience. They wanted to detail what was going on here, and that's natural that a culture should develop, that a literature should develop, but they're all working under that shadow. They all write about it in one way or another.
Rabbi Jeffrey Sachs, editor of the brand new Shai Agnon series, Toby Press. The book is called A Simple Story by Agnon. We'll get to that in a moment. Based on the background you gave us in terms of his background, Talmudic, scholarly, cheder, etc., would you call him a Talmudic scholar? Do his writings reflect somebody who obviously had a very familiar background and a very familiar educational collection of Talmud and the like?
Sure. I mean, he was a very, very, very learned Jew. I think some would call a Talmud Chacham. He was not a rabbi. I mentioned that there was this period in his youth where he moved away from traditional observance.
Right.
In 1924, when he came back to Israel, he came back to actually the land of Israel, after his house in Germany burns down, he comes back and he lives in Jerusalem. At that point, he returned to traditional observance. He returned to a kind of orthodox lifestyle. But even throughout his life, in both periods, when he had the yarmulke on his head and when he didn't have the yarmulke on his head, he was always engaged in Jewish learning, and Jewish learning, principally Gemara. His daughter, who became his literary executor after he died and published many of his posthumous writings, things that were in the archives but hadn't been published in his lifetime, so his daughter has a memoir that she wrote where she describes, you know, he had a habit, he would rise early in the morning, and he would, you know, before sunrise, and he would sit and he would learn a Daf Gemara or a chapter in the Rambam. This was both Talmud Torah, the work of all engaged Jews, but one suspects it was also, on some level, you know, the kind of absorbing of the raw material that one needs to be what he thought needed to be a great Hebrew writer.
Right.
You had to immerse yourself in the entire Jewish bookshelf of the entirety of Hebrew literature.
Was there
a contemporary Hebrew writer named Aaron Appelfeld. He's also been widely translated into English. He's a man now. He's in his 80s. He himself was a Holocaust survivor, and he was hidden in the forests as a child. He was in a concentration camp at one point, and he escaped, and he lived the war in the forests. And then after the war, he came as a child on the youth aliyah to Israel, and he thought his whole family. It was one of those interesting stories that you hear about, you know, today, of course. He thought his family had all been killed. It turned out that his father survived, thinking that he had been killed, and only, you know, years later did they reconnect in Jerusalem. And Appelfeld, who was, as opposed to the other members of his generation, as I was describing, who were, you know, wanted to move on, Appelfeld was still and is still writing about the Holocaust and the old world. And he said he got validation for that from Agnon, but Agnon told him, your problem, Appelfeld, he writes this in his memoirs, he says, your problem, Appelfeld, is that you didn't sit in Beis Medrash, you didn't sit and learn. In order to be a great Hebrew writer, you have to learn Torah. And he pointed specifically to the writings of Rabbi Nachman of Breslov as a kind of bedrock of modern Jewish storytelling.
So 1 second.
And Appelfeld.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah. I was going to say, let's turn.
Appelfeld told me that he does this. He,
right.
He, every day he learns.
He took his advice. Text. He took his advice to heart.
Yeah.
Let's turn the tables on that for a moment. Did Agnon have a literary hero? Somebody outside of the Talmud and Jewish sources who, you know, on the collegiate level or whatever other period of.
Sure.
Agnon had no
kind of formal education. Besides those couple of years of cheder, you know, he didn't go to high school, he didn't go to university, but he was extremely well-read in European literature, and he pointed to certain influences. He was influenced by, although interesting, you know, we talk about reading in translation, he could really only read read world literature in German. So French literature, Russian literature, English literature, he read in translation himself. But he was particularly influenced by Flaubert, by Balzac, and other figures, by certain Scandinavian authors, Hamsun and others. There were certain influences that he admitted to. There were other influences that he ardently, for some reason, denied. You can see the influences on the work in terms of areas of focus, but in terms of style, it's this interesting Agnonian experiment or you know, kind of part of his accomplishment is that as he was writing, as the language, you know, he's writing Hebrew in the first decade of the 20th century, in the 20s, in the 30s, and he's inventing a language as it's flowing out of his pen.
Right.
Because modern Hebrew was not set in stone the way it is today, to whatever degree any language
is. Is he responsible for any words or phrases in modern Hebrew of today?
Yes. He was also involved in, there were larger cultural battles about the direction that Hebrew should go, battles between Chaim Nachman Bialik, the great poet who was a bit older than Agnon, but they were close friends. And on the other side, Eliezer ben Yehuda, who's often considered the father of modern Hebrew, or the reviver of modern Hebrew. And these two sides didn't always agree, and there were fierce battles about certain words and phrases and turns of phrase or directions that the language should go in. Agnon felt very strongly that they had to go back, again, principally to the language of Chazal, to rabbinic Hebrew. But that influence, you know, was there. But to a certain degree, Hebrew took a different turn.
You know,
modern readers of Hebrew think that he's, you know, overly flowery, overly, it sounds almost something antiquated about it, something old world about it.
Rabbi Sachs, when someone, you know, asks me about a Jewish music great from the past, you know, what can I listen to for 5-10 minutes that'll give me a real taste of what they were all about? I'm able to answer that question generally. If someone asks you, you know, what's the one work of Agnon? You know, if I have time to read one of them, what's the one work of Agnon that'll give me a real feel for, you know, for what he was able to do and what he accomplished in the world of literature? Which one would it be?
Well, there's a book that we at Toby put out. It was put out before I became involved with the project. It was a number of years ago. It's a collection of 35 short stories called on the name of the title story. It's called A Book That Was Lost, 35 stories. I think that's a good place to start. And then there's this new volume that we just put out called A Simple Story, which is a rather complex story, of course. The purpose of the title, I tried to address the purpose of that title in the new preface I wrote. It's a revised translation. It was a translation that was done by Hillel Halkin, who's really one of the great translators of Hebrew to English today, as well as a very, very cogent essayist and thinker and writer about things generally related to Israel and Zionism. So he translated the book about 20 years ago, and we revised the translation for a variety of reasons. And I wrote a new preface, and Halkin has an afterword in this revised translation. And that's if you want to start with one of the novels, that's the best, probably the best place to start.
How is it known? By what Hebrew title is A Simple Story known?
In Hebrew, it's called Sipur Pashut, and the translation is A Simple Story.
Can't get any more simple than that. It's a direct translation of the title. Simple as that.
Although that question about what the title means is a little tricky.
Because it's not as simple as one may think based on
the title. Well, it's certainly not as simple as it means. Agnon was a great ironist. So how ironic is he trying to be? And to what degree does he mean the Sipur Pashut mean a simple story? And to what degree, and he's probably playing off of, there's a Yiddish translation of the story. The book was written in the 30s and it was translated into Yiddish for the very many people that were still, you know, reading Yiddish. And in Yiddish it's called a Poshut Maisa. But it's also possible, which, you know, there literally it means a simple story, but it's also possible that it means a Sipur Shehit Pashet, a kind of story that got spread around. It's a story, it's a love story. It's actually all of Agnon's love stories, none of them have they lived happily ever after. They all kind of end on a
heartbreak.
A sour note, a conflicted note, a heartbreak note, or an ambivalent note at best. So this is a story which is Shehit Pashet, which has been spread. Every culture has a story like this. Every culture has a story of star-crossed love. So Agnon's saying, well, let's look at what would it look like to write a Jewish story set, you know, in the beginning of the 20th century in a small Jewish town in Europe, played out on the background of class consciousness and the upper class, lower class, a boy meets girl, girl is poor, boy is nouveau riche. What do his parents want? How much can parents control what their kids do? No, this is a story that we all know.
Right. It's the old story.
You know, right?
It's the old story, I said, you know.
Right. Well, it's a simple story in the sense that we all know it.
Right.
You know, we've seen this movie before, but what's interesting is what he does with it. And that's the interesting work.
Those who love character development, because I know there are a lot of people who love reading fiction and are intrigued with character development, it sounds like they would go for a work like this.
I would think so, yeah.
Agnon was married with kids or never married or what? What was his personal situation?
No, he was married. He married when he was in Germany. He married the daughter of a German Jewish family, a very wealthy family who were besides themselves with this shidduch. They came to terms with it eventually, but they couldn't believe that their Yekesha daughter was marrying this Polish Yid who had both gone on Aliyah already and was planning on returning to Jerusalem, but also he wasn't a banker or a merchant, or he was a writer. They didn't know what to make of him. But he married a woman named Esther Marx was her maiden name, and she really is something of an unsung hero in his success, because he would write. He had the habit. If you visit the Agnon house today, you can see his study where he worked. He worked at a writing stand, you know, kind of like a big stender.
Right.
He wrote longhand, standing up, and then she would type the manuscripts. And he had a famously difficult handwriting to decipher. All of his manuscripts today are in the National Archives, the National Library, rather, in Jerusalem, and scholars can access them. You can see how he was an inveterate reviser. He would revise and polish. Every time the works would be reissued, he would change them. So part of the work of the scholarship is to trace the different drafts and the different versions and see what he did. She would decipher that chicken scratchy handwriting and type up the manuscripts. And he had two children, both of whom are still alive. They're both in their 90s. And they do come around to things at the Agnon house from time to time.
Are they known by the name Agnon?
His son is known by the name Agnon, and his daughter is married. So her name was Emuna Agnon Yaron. And like I said, she was really responsible for putting out more of his books after he died than he put out in his own lifetime. Right. There were many things that were published in journals and newspapers and periodicals that had never been collected in book form. And then there were a lot of things that were just in manuscript and had not been published at all. And following his instructions, she undertook that project for many years after his death in 1970 to put out all of those posthumous volumes as well. But he took Agnon as a pen name, but as the fashion when people came to Aliyah, they also Hebrewized their names, leaving behind the Yiddishy or European names, taking Hebrew names, so it became his actual name. And his family name as well.
So it sounds like success needs some teamwork between his wife and his kids and people around him. It was a collaborative effort to make sure that his works were disseminated. Is the goal of, Toby Press has this project and you're the editor. Is the goal to eventually have everything in English that was written by Agnon?
No, unfortunately, there's not, a mandate to do that. What we're doing now is two things. We are reissuing most of the books that have already been published in English. Toby Press has required those reprint rights, but we're in most cases we're revising the translations, correcting errors, mistranslations, adding annotations that help the reader, both the Jewish reader that wants to connect with those sources, but since you're reading in English, you would miss them, as well as the general reader. Agnon is on university curricula in secular universities, world literature, or Hebrew literature courses in universities in America and elsewhere. So you could have a non-Jew, somebody very distant from Jewish learning, who needs some filling in on Jewish tradition and Jewish practices, so we're adding that kind of annotation. And in each case, we're trying to add something new, annotated bibliography, a kind of bibliographical essays on what in this new edition of Simple Story. So I have an annotated bibliography of the best and most interesting things that have been written on this work. Since it was written 75 years ago or so, it's been the subject of uninterrupted fascination on the part of the literary critics. Well, what have people said about it? So we have that kind of appendix to the book, and things of that nature. And then we're also doing some new translations. The next volume, which will be coming out, is a collection of four novellas. The lead story in that collection is called Two Scholars Who Were in Our Town. In Hebrew, it's a work called Shnei Talmidei Chachamim Shehayu Bi'irenu. which is really one of his most important stories, most significant stories, and for some reason it's gone untranslated up until now, and now there were two translators that worked on it, and it's coming out now with annotations, and it'll be the first time that it's available to the English reading crowd.
Was he a romantic about the old world, or through his writings it would sound like he was happy to leave it?
No, not at all. He was, I wouldn't say romantic, I'd say he was nostalgic.
Uh-huh.
There's the best book, if somebody wants to read a book about Agnon in English, the best book is a book that was written still in his lifetime by Professor Arnold Band from UCLA. It's called, Nostalgia and Nightmare. It's rather encyclopedic, but it, of course it only covers the works that were published in Agnon's lifetime. It was never revised to include all of the posthumous writings. But Nostalgia Nightmare, and that really captures something of what he's saying about that world. There's both a nostalgia for it, but there's also this sense of watching a world that's crumbling. And in this regard, it's, you know, again, we're talking on Yom HaShoah.
Right.
And the question of the Shoah in his writing is something that we can have a whole hour-long discussion about maybe next Yom HaShoah.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't play a... at least on the surface, doesn't play a very significant role. Because, again, well, first of all, much of his writing was completed
before
in the teens, 20s, and 30s.
Right.
Before the Shoah. But even the things that he's writing after the Shoah are usually stories, with some exceptions, are usually stories that are set in the 19th century, in the early 20th century. So on the surface, they're not directly talking about the Shoah, but yet everything really is. In the sense that he's trying to capture a world that no longer exists. Now, that world no longer exists because it was exterminated all over Poland and Germany and Europe. But it's also a world that no longer exists because we who live on this side of that great historical chasm look back on what was before and we realize that not only was that wiped out, but we've been changed. And he'll write a story about the world before, a world of simpler faith. But really, it's a story set maybe in the 19th century. But it's really about us.
Right.
Because it helps us, we standing on this side of history, looking back, the degree to which we are no longer people that can live with simple faith.
And that was one of the things you meant when you early on in this conversation spoke of self-analysis or self-introspection based on his work?
These are things that you learn. These are things that you learn about yourself by immersing immersing yourself in Agnon.
Right. It's not
you
just
also learn something about how to read carefully and how to think about the Jewish sources that make up the whoop and wharf of our lives. And so, you also learn something about the degree to which the world of the Beit Midrash can and should inform a larger culture. We're not always successful at doing that, and you'll pardon me, in America, even less so than we are here in Israel.
Right.
In Israel, we're far from achieved it. But it's a model that, you know, for those of us for whom Torah study is our first commitment, it's an interesting model for what does it look like to have that flavor and shape in everything you do. We all, to one degree or another, you know, read, or at least we would like to think that we read. We read literature. We'd like to think that we're reading good literature, but not always. We're absorbing culture, popular culture. We'd like to think it's enriching, but not always. Here's a cultural product, that high cultural product, which helps you think about who you are as a person, who you are as a people, what your relationship to these questions of Torah and mitzvot and the land of Israel and other Jews and Jews that are nice and Jews that are naughty and our relationship to the world outside of Israel, the world that was, the world that still is outside of Israel. These are all questions that you're going to bump up against.
Right.
In your reading of Agnon. And he doesn't, it's not the Mora Nevuchim, it's not the Guide for the Perplexed. He's not writing a Musar Sefer. Again, he's not a Rebbe. He's not telling you what to do or think. But he's going to help you think about these things. You have to come to your own conclusions.
I wanted to...
Part of the riddle is trying to figure out what he thinks. He was always very cagey. Like in reality, people would ask him. Again, even before he won the prize, he was one of the most famous men of letters in the country. And people would ask him, well, what do you think about this, that, or the other thing? And he would never tell you what he had to think. He would say, oh, well, I wrote a story about that once. And they would say, well, what story? They'd say, I forgot. And he would play with people like that. But even if you knew what story he was talking about, you'd have to interpret it to understand
right.
what he's saying.
And to figure out what he would use as an analysis for that situation. I wanted to interject earlier that while he would agree, it sounds like, that you can't go home again, his further point was that we may not be ready to go home again. That, you know, that we are a different people, or as individuals, we are different than the person who left home, so to speak.
Sure, you can never step in that same river twice.
Also, you mentioned this
idea of you can't go home again is certainly...
You also mentioned the relationship with Rav Kook, or at least his admiration for Rav Kook. Is there anything we would find as scholars reading his work that sounds Kookian, that sounds like a tremendous influence from Rav Kook?
Yeah, there are a few things, and there are a few essays, although I don't believe any of them are in English. There are a few essays that have been written by scholars in Hebrew about that relationship and that connection. There's a letter in Rav Kook's letters, that's in the standard set of Rav Kook's writings. There's a letter that's addressed to answering a Shaila. Nothing of great significance, and I was never able to find if it somehow influenced, if it showed up as an element in a story. To the best of my knowledge, it didn't. There's a letter that's addressed to the young Mr. Tchotchkes, which was his name at the time, probably written in the first decade of the 20th century. And there are a few characters in some of the stories that seem to be not fictionalized Rav Kook, but seem to be representing or seem to be a mouthpiece for the worldview that Rav Kook embodied. One novel in particular, which we will be reissuing, called A Guest for the Night. In Hebrew, it's called Oreach Natal Alun, which is Agnon's most significant Zionist work. It's a very powerful statement about Zionism, about the land of Israel, although it takes place 95% outside of Israel. It takes place in this fictionalized version of his hometown,
right,
in Galicia, but it ends here in Jerusalem, and there's a main character who somehow seems to be a mouthpiece for Rav Kook's point of view about Torah Eretz Yisrael, the Torah of the land of Israel, and other things. So.
Very interesting. Rabbi Jeffrey Sachs, he is the editor of the brand new Shai Agnon series from Toby Press. Toby Press, an imprint of Koren Publishers in Yerushalayim, has launched the Shai Agnon Library, bringing the works of the Nobel Prize laureate to the English-speaking public. Through fiction stories, Agnon attempts to weave together thousands of years of Jewish literature, Bible, Midrash, Talmud, into the art of modern storytelling. Now in its newly revised series, Rabbi Sachs is dedicated to reinvigorate the works of this oft-neglected writer. The Agnon Library has released 4 novellas in this series, To This Day, which was never before translated into English, A Book That Was Lost, which you mentioned earlier, Shira, and this new one that we were featuring entitled A Simple Story, with a revised translation and with an afterword by Hillel Halkin. The series is slated to consist of 9 volumes in total. Rabbi Sachs, I take this opportunity to wish you continued hatzlacha, continued good luck with this series. You have been a very interesting and enlightening guest, and I would love to know what Agnon would have said about this conversation if he was with us.
Me too. I'll just add, probably by the time we're done, there'll probably be about a dozen volumes.
Oh, wow.
And one of the upcoming volumes should be particularly interesting to readers or anybody who's involved in education or anybody with children. It's a graphic novel. It'll be called From Foe to Friend and Other Stories. It'll be 3 stories that I guess particularly appropriate for children in comic book form, illustrated by, there's a very well-known Israeli illustrator and comic illustrator named Shai Charka, and this will be an English-language edition of that of that book, which will be coming out sometime in the next few months.
And I assume if people need information or want information about Atid, the Academy for Torah Initiatives and Directions, or Web Yeshiva, they could search either of them on the web.
Either of them. Certainly, again, visit us at webyeshiva.org/Agdon for more on those lectures and those programs, and the Toby Press for the series of new books.
Rabbi Sacks, I thank you very much. This has been enlightening.
Thank you, Nachum.
And tremendous. Thank you so much. Continued Hatzlacha. There he is, Rabbi Jeffrey Sacks, who is the editor of the brand new Shai Agnon series from Toby Press. Go to korenpub.com, korenpub.com, for information. Just search Toby Press and you'll find the entire collection of their works. And this, as you just heard, the Agnon series is going to include a tremendous number of his works, but a time it is concluded. My thanks to our friends at the Koren Publications, as we have brought you yet another interesting editor in this case, in the world of Jewish literature, Jewish authorship, Jewish works. And you could hear this segment by the book in its original form every Tuesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time right here at the Nachum Segal Network. NSN presents By the Book from our friends at Koren Publications each and every week. Check out the website, korenpub.com, and search Toby Press for any information you need about today's projects that we discussed or any of their incredible works. I thank you for listening to the Nachum Segal Network.